This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West here on RN and on your pod. The times demand leadership that's honest and ethical. What can we learn from a famous writer who perished in the last great pandemic?
The politician needs to balance two ethics, an ethic of moral conviction with an ethic of responsibility. And the ethic of moral conviction refers to the unshakable beliefs that a politician must hold. And the ethic of responsibility referred to the need to use the state in a fashion which preserves the collective good.
That's ahead on the show. Yes, it's 100 years since Max Weber died, and we'll ask what lessons his famous essay, Politics as a Vocation, holds for leaders dealing with the COVID-19 crisis. Also an ethicist who's been helping Australian governments with their coronavirus response joins us. Now, it was supposed to be a sign that after decades of religious tension, Pakistan was beginning a new era of tolerance. Prime Minister Imran Khan recently announced his government would help fund a Hindu temple in the capital, Islamabad. The country's top Muslim clerics also supported the push for minority rights, including for the 3-4% who are Hindu. But now a mob has demolished the foundations of the planned Sri Krishna temple, and with it, the hope of religious pluralism. Professor Samina Yasmin is director of the Centre for Muslim States and Societies at the University of Western Australia. She's also from a prominent liberal family in Pakistan, and I asked Samina to explain the situation.
Suddenly, it started becoming a political issue in Pakistan. Those who are not happy with the Pakistan government's policies, they become party to that. At the same time, they're also religious clergy who in this area have been very active in using Islam for political purposes or even to increase their own status. They got into the picture and they started taking a very strong stand. So one, they basically destroyed the place, even went there and performed a call to prayer for Muslims. And at the same time, they also started saying that Islamabad is the place of Islam. Strictly speaking, that could be the translation. And you cannot have a Hindu temple in Islamabad. One person who, in fact, even recorded a song which is very critical of Pakistani Hindus as Indians and telling them that no matter what happens, you will not have a temple in Islamabad. So basically, it's become part of a drama which really engages Pakistan's identity as a Muslim state, but also presents this as a place where the struggle between Islam and Hinduism has to be played out.
But it is fascinating, Samina, because the Pakistan Ulema Council, which is a council of very high-ranking Muslim clerics, has come out in support of the construction of the first Hindu temple in Islamabad. So who is agitating against it when you have the most respected Islamic leaders in the country saying, no, we need to have more religious pluralism?
We need to understand that in Pakistan since the 1980s, Islam has been presented as the main defining characteristic of Pakistan's identity. And the Islamization policies that were introduced by General Zia were not really criticized by the subsequent governments. They've created a whole structure in which you don't have to be a very significant, respected religious clergy. All you need to do is to stand up and say, you understand Islam, and you're standing for Islam. And I think it's really that position which has been assumed by some of the religious clergy who are not at the same standard as the Pakistan Ulema Council, but they have started mobilizing support, objecting to the construction. So there's a struggle between a more moderate, pluralistic, and more accepting religious clergy that does go back to the original Islamic teachings and says it is the responsibility of the state to take care of its religious minorities and those who go back to, again, Islamic history and use the logic of the limits placed upon religious minorities once they have been made part of an Islamic state through occupation. There's these two different struggles going on in terms of whose Islam is really valid and who can mobilize the support.
We know that on the face of it, Prime Minister Imran Khan was very supportive of the Hindu temple being built. He is a man with a cosmopolitan reputation, shall we say, from his days as an Oxford graduate and then an international test cricketer. But in reality, where does Imran Khan actually stand on religious pluralism? Because I'm sure you and I have discussed that in the past, he's kind of flirted with hardliners, hasn't he?
He definitely has shown his support or acceptance of hardliners. And if we look at the ways Imran Khan has shifted from what you refer to as his days in Oxford and also being a very popular cricket captain, to today's Prime Minister Imran Khan, we see that there's a gradual shift in him focusing more and more on Islamic identity of Pakistan and himself as a Pakistani Muslim. In fact, very recently, there was a huge sort of argument within the National Assembly because he referred to Osama bin Laden as a shaheed or a martyr, and people objected to that. So given all that, I think at one level, he's definitely committed to the idea of a pluralistic Pakistan, which respects its minorities. If we think about the decision by the Pakistan government to really develop the Kartarpur area and open a link between India and Pakistan so that Sikhs could come in, we can see that religious minorities are being given a lot of significance. But at the same time, because he constantly also talks about Pakistan's Islamic identity, you can see that he is reluctant to take a very definitive stand against religious fanaticism.
Do you think his heart was really in it, though, when he did describe Osama bin Laden as a martyr? Because I understand the context in which he said it was one where he was talking about the national shame of having foreign troops come onto Pakistan's soil to apprehend and kill Osama bin Laden. Was his heart really in it, referring to bin Laden as a martyr?
We don't really know whose heart is in it or not, but the point is that even if it's said as a prime minister, he should not have said that. And in that case, I could draw a parallel between what President Bush said about the Crusades. As the president, he should not have said that. In the same way, Imran Khan should have avoided such statements. But I think it also indicates his way of looking at the world. But if we had to look at what's happening in Pakistan in terms of religious minorities' push for pluralism, and this particular case that we're talking about, we have to accept that for him to accept the idea of building this temple, agreeing to giving some money, that obviously indicated a willingness to engage the Hindu minority, which among the 4% minorities of Pakistan is the largest minority. But having taken the decision, he's not willing to take a strong stand and argue in favor of the Hindu minority's right. They've just presented this to the Council for Islamic Ideology and asked them to give an opinion. So effectively what they're really saying is, we made the decision, but now we are not sure if an Islamic state or a state with majority Muslims should really help build a temple. So let the Council for Islamic Ideology decide. That's a cop-out.
But how much of this is part of the geopolitical stoush between Pakistan and India? Because as we know, Indian Prime Minister Modi introduced a citizenship law that was seen to be very exclusionary of Muslims. Is this an attempt by Imran Khan, even if it stalled at the moment, to say we're more open-minded than you in India?
I think that's part of the explanation because of the timing. I would also say that if we look at the composition of the community that actually supports Imran Khan, and the one that gives him an idea about what the so-called new Pakistan should look like, a lot of them are the ones who have been educated overseas. They have lived as Muslims in Western liberal societies, as minorities. And I think when they have come back into Pakistan, or even if they're supporting Imran Khan from overseas, they're very aware of the fact that Pakistan's religious minorities also have rights. But I also want to point out that it's not just simply this community. If we look at another set of temples, which is very close to Islamabad, even in 2018, the Supreme Court Chief Justice had taken a very strong stand in favor of Hindus, because they go there every year, to say that their special lake in that temple should be protected and the water shouldn't be depleted by cement factories, I think, around the area. They shouldn't be taking away the water. So the pressure or the sense of the rights of minorities is in Pakistan, partly by these educated elite, but also by the judiciary. Mm-hmm. So Imran Khan definitely is building on that. But is it only because of geopolitical reasons? I'd say no. But can we exclude geopolitical explanations? Again, the answer is no.
Professor Samina Yasmeen of the Centre for Muslim States and Societies at the University of Western Australia. At the Religion and Ethics Report homepage, you can find a longer version of that chat where we explore why much of the Islamic world is not supporting the Uyghur Muslims who are being persecuted by China. And you're with Andrew West. In Victoria, infection rates for coronavirus are rising. About 5 million people are again in lockdown, with the possibility that the Andrews government could impose even tougher restrictions on citizens. It's an awful position for any leader because the choices seem so stark. Without lockdown, epidemiologists say the pandemic will tear through the community. Make the lockdowns too harsh and you will throttle the livelihoods of working class people and worsen isolation and mental health. Dr. Jane Williams is a researcher with the Sydney Health Ethics Team at the University of Sydney. The team's been advising the federal and New South Wales governments, and Jane joined me earlier.
When we were all staying at home a lot in March and April, we had a feeling that it was a short-term thing. You know, this is what we needed to do. We were doing it for the greater good. There were definitely people who were really massively impacted by that, people whose businesses folded, people who lost their jobs. And there was the feeling that it wasn't going to be an ongoing situation. You know, we would do this really difficult thing and then it would be done and we'd be sorted, for want of a better word. If it seems that that wasn't effective, then it might be really, really difficult for people to commit to doing it again. Yeah. Things like job losses. I know a lot of people really struggled with having their kids home all the time. Their children suffered as well. Those sorts of things can kind of manifest in some fairly direct harms. You know, we've heard that there's been a lot of increased need, I guess, from mental health organizations needing to support people who are really suffering. That might be that they're suffering for practical reasons associated with, you know, less freedom, less income, real uncertainty about what happens next. Or it could be that they're really struggling because it's really hard to stay at home and have you try and hold down a job and have your kids under your feet all day.
For very good reasons, Jane, a lot of very highly respected epidemiologists and infectious disease experts have been giving governments, if you like, as close to the 100% solution as they see it to this crisis. You're in the business of public policy making. What would you say is the duty of the politician in this case? Do they go to the most 100% solution in its isolation, as it were? Or what other factors are they going to have to consider?
Yeah, I think the problem is that these things never are in isolation. Obviously, I think it would be fabulous if we had some surefire 100% way of getting rid of COVID-19 in Australia. And we do. We could all completely isolate. I don't know quite how we manage some of the practicalities, but let's just say that we get to a situation where we don't have any community transmission and we were almost there for a while. What do we do in the long term? We don't know whether or not there will be a vaccine. We can certainly hope there will be a vaccine. If there is, it won't be here anytime soon. So at what point do we say, well, are we going to live completely differently from how we were living a year ago? And that's okay. That's more beneficial to us. Or do we say, well, no, we need to accept that this infection is part of the way we live now, and that is a difficult thing. And I'm not advocating for some sort of herd immunity type response that other governments have mooted, but it's difficult. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that we can see any public health intervention in a vacuum. It doesn't exist by itself.
Yeah. You're not advocating herd immunity, but you're raising a really fascinating philosophical and ethical question here, Jane, and that is COVID-19 a part of nature that we can defeat or that we simply have to accept and manage?
My thinking, and of course I'm not an infectious disease expert, I work on ethics, my thinking is that this needs to be managed as part of our lives because it's not a thing that we can carve out as being completely separate from the rest of life and gotten rid of. It's in our lives now. It needs managing in a way that also looks to the other values that we have, and that might be things like human contact, being able to have relations, I guess, with people in other countries, working relationships, family relationships, and so on. I wonder if those things are so big now in the way we live that we can't completely close ourselves off in order to try and eliminate this virus. It would be really interesting to talk to an infectious diseases person about this. They might have a totally different perspective from mine because I'm not talking about the pathogen. I'm not talking about the actual virus. I'm talking about the way we live with it, I suppose.
Is there an ethical difference between doing something that you know will actively cause death and damage and failing to act in a way that may cause damage, but having, if you like, a higher motive, even a more noble motive? In this case, the noble motive might simply be to allow natural human relations to flourish over the long term.
I think there is a difference. The first thing that comes to mind is the harm principle that underpins a lot of public health ethics. If we know that something is going to be harmful to another person, it is very difficult to justify doing it. For example, we don't let people drive when they're drunk. There's a high risk of harming somebody else. Benefits and harms, depending on who you talk to, for us, they're not really this countable thing. I know that health economists, for example, count lives. They count quality-adjusted life years and disability-adjusted life years, all of that sort of thing. We don't do that so much because I think benefits and harms are really talking about what matters. And what matters changes over time. At the beginning of this pandemic, what mattered was trying to stop it. We didn't understand enough about it. Everybody was scared, and I think still is scared. The public sentiment was that it was okay for us to stop our lives to try to stop this virus. Since that point, I think we're being more open also about the harms to mental health, the harms to, I don't want to say the economy, but the harms to people's incomes and well-being, perhaps.
Yeah, what do you make of this binary, as it were, that's been set up? You either stay home and save lives, or it's just about going out, making money and partying.
Well, I don't think it's helpful. When we talk about the economy, we're talking about it as if it's this sort of disembodied thing that exists on its own and doesn't sort of have anything to do with people. If people are losing their jobs, losing their livelihoods, losing their community connections, not going to the doctors because they're worried about COVID, but actually they have symptoms of something else, people will die for all sorts of reasons. We know, for example, that things like cancer diagnoses are down because people aren't going to the doctors. We hear that there is the potential for an increased number of suicides as a result of, well, all of the things that lockdown has triggered for all sorts of people, we know that domestic violence is worse in lockdown. This is why it's not a binary, right? There are all sorts of benefits and harms associated with all sorts of different ways of doing things.
Dr. Jane Williams of the Sydney University Health Ethics Team. Finally today, it's 100 years since the great German intellectual Max Weber died in circumstances very similar to today. Weber was a scholar of religion, science, politics and economics. His famous book, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, is something I'd love to be talking about, but the times demand that we look at his most notable essay because it says a lot about ethics in a crisis. Stuart Clegg is a scholar of Weber at the University of Technology, Sydney, and he recalls the circumstances of Weber's death.
Well, he died in a pandemic, much more severe than the one we're having today, but similar in its global distribution. It was the Spanish flu virus, which flared in the aftermath of the First World War. Over 50 million people died from this, and there were several waves of contagion. Weber died in the second wave of contagion on June 14, 1920, as you say, just over 100 years ago.
Hadn't Weber at one point been in charge of a hospital?
It was during the First World War, and so he was looking after wounded soldiers and others who were in hospital as a hospital administrator, and this was the nature of his war service during the First War.
Weber is known for several classic works, including Capitalism and the Protestant Work Ethic, something that we would probably normally talk about on this program, but given the conditions today, there are two pieces of work that I want to address, and they are his essays on science as a vocation and politics as a vocation. What did he say very briefly in Science as a Vocation?
In Science as a Vocation, he argued that anybody who chose to adopt the vocation of science had to do so in absolute pursuit of the value of truth, the values of science. They couldn't be beholden to ideological or political convictions with which they would massage or change or usurp or undercut or undermine the values of science. The values of science had to be absolutely predominant for any professional who professed to be a scientist.
Politics as a vocation, the one that I particularly remember, though, was a lot more ambiguous, wasn't it?
Yes, this was a speech that he gave to students, I think in Munich, quite late in the First World War. And one of his main points was that the politician needs to balance two ethics. He talked about an ethic of moral conviction with an ethic of responsibility. And the ethic of moral conviction refers to the unshakable beliefs, the core beliefs that a politician must hold. And the ethic of responsibility referred to the day-to-day need to use the state and all of the means it afforded in a fashion which preserves the peace and the collective good. According to Weber, a politician constantly has to make compromises between the two ethics.
Yeah. He also said something, though, about the state and its monopoly on coercion, which is, I think, something that really resonates today. What did he say about that?
He defined the state as that organization that had a monopoly of the legitimate use of the means of violence. And for him, that was what defined a state. I think it was perhaps a little narrow as a definition. We probably would want to add a monopoly over the means of taxation as well. I think that's an important element of the monopoly powers of the state. Other than that qualification, the definition holds fairly well for most states, although perhaps not the United States, where the Second Amendment means the state can often be confronted by other organizations, non-state organizations, who can claim that they have a legitimate right and therefore that there is no monopoly to the means of violence.
When we think about those three elements of Weber's essay on politics as a vocation, and that is the state and its monopoly on coercion or violence, and then the duty of the politician to balance principle with practice, why do you think this is so relevant today?
We've lived through a period of time of government in which there's been a very strong moral conviction in terms of balanced budgets, in terms of delivering a surplus. And we've seen that abandoned with haste in the face of an obdurate reality that the virus presents. And we should be thankful that those moral convictions were abandoned, I think, in the face of this virus. Lord Keynes, Maynard Keynes, once said that when the facts change, one should really change one's mind. And that's clearly what's happened with our federal and other politicians at the moment.
What did he say was the ethic of ultimate ends?
The ultimate ends could sometimes determine the action. And those ultimate ends, he hoped, would be shaped by the ethic of responsibility.
What did Weber say, just to remind us, Stuart, about the ideal politician?
Well, an ideal politician would be not a dilettante. That would be the ideal. A dilettante would be, there are plenty of dilettantes that we can choose in the contemporary world. Politicians who live by highly changeable conviction, who live by the convictions that their pollsters provide them with, and lack a core of professional ethic, lack a core of a central civic responsibility. So his first advice would be that politicians should not be dilettante. The second would be that politics is a vocation, and it's one that has to be taken very seriously. And the seriousness of that vocation can be judged by the extent to which the ethic of responsibility is discharged.
I think, though, and this might be relevant to the question, though, of science, I think he was probably, a little bit sceptical about how well a scientist might fare in politics, a scientist wedded to absolute truth all the time, no matter what.
A scientist would lack the flexibility to make those pragmatic choices that a politician always has to make. Politicians have to weigh the scales of reasoning in a way in which the scientist does not. The scientist only has to value the logic of explanation, the logic of discovery, and the results that that produces, and they should report those fearlessly. The politician is not similarly equipped.
And I'm not sure if this was a compliment or not, but didn't he say that lawyers and journalists were probably best equipped to enter politics?
I think his idea there was that lawyers and journalists are people who can... they have a degree of agility with being economical with the truth, to capture a phrase that I think Malcolm Turnbull first coined. They have that flexibility in the face of facts and the logic of science to be able to deviate from any straightforwardness that that logic might impose.
Yeah, although just to bring people like me down to earth, I think he did say that it is not astonishing that there are many journalists who have become human failures and worthless men.
Well, I think that's probably a little unkind.
Well, I'm not about to launch myself on the Australian public. It's been terrific to speak with you. Professor Stuart Clegg, he's a professor in the School of Management at UTS, and he is an expert on Max Weber. Thanks for joining us on the program, Stuart.
It's a pleasure.
And that's the Religion and Ethics Report for this week. We're at the podcast or at iTunes. Thanks to Mutta Tadias and Emrys Cronin. I'm Andrew West. I'm back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.